Frenchie may wanna come, I'll probably check.
Okay. We're having a problem, we've got over 300 people.
Is that right?
And of course, some will come, some won't.
Been around long enough.
Doctor, we will be taking testimony from the proponents, and I think if you could remain for a few minutes, we may have some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Some dialogue in the wake of that that might help the subcommittee further.
My time is available to whatever I can do to help you this afternoon, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Groen?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, my name's Ken Gaughan. I'm the president of Lynn, or Sheriff of Lynn County, president of the Oregon State Sheriff Association. In listening to Dr. Brady's testimony, I don't think there's a great deal that he said that the sheriffs are in opposition to. I think we pretty well agree with most of the things he said. The thing we're in great disagreement of is if you read the present law, it provides for the medical examiner's office and the district attorney to determine cause of death. We most certainly think that ought to be the way it is now. But there's no provision in there for law enforcement to investigate the perpetrators of the crime, to track down the evidence that goes on for months and sometimes years after the death. In this particular or current law, that's the district attorney's responsibility. We can't conceive that the legislature ever intended to leave law enforcement entirely out of death investigations, especially as it relates to homicide and so forth. What has happened as a result of this bill, many of the overzealous district attorneys have taken that bail to mean that they are totally responsible for the investigation of the tracking down of the perpetrator. We in law enforcement believe that's a law enforcement function. Cause of death, yes. We think that should be a function of the medical profession, and we think this bill meets that very well. We don't think that death investigation should be turned the tracking down of the perpetrator, the securing of the crime scene, and these sort of things should be left up to local medical examiners, the state medical examiner. We think they should be left up to law enforcement.
Mr. Lombard.
Sheriff, how is it that you are hampered, if you are, by the current law? In other words, how do you feel that the current law inhibits your ability to track down the perpetrator?
Well, because in most deaths, the death investigation itself is, and the direction of that death investigation is usually ends up not by Dr. Brady's office or not by the local medical examiner. They come and do their thing and go home. It usually ends up by being, under their interpretation of the law, the district attorney takes that investigation over and directs it. In very many counties, a great number of the deputy district attorneys are fresh out of law school, don't know very much about criminal investigation. A lot of counties, the district attorneys themselves don't know very much about criminal investigation. They don't have the staffs to do criminal investigations. The chiefs of police and the sheriffs and the state police have got the staffs to do the work. And personally, I resent my staff being directed by district attorney. I think I ought to direct my staff. I'm elected sheriff of my county, I was elected for that purpose. And I don't think that the legislature ever intended to take the sheriff of any county out of the death investigation business or any other kind of criminal investigation. That's what this bill, as it presently is, does. All we're asking for is that the bill be left alone, left as it is. Just add law enforcement in. We think it worked a lot better if there's three inputs in that instead of only two.
How is it, sort of functionally, are death investigations occurring under the present law in terms of the working relationship between, let's say, the sheriff's office and the district attorney? Are you being directed by the district attorneys as to how personnel of your office should be committed and used?
Most counties, that's what's happening now. The sheriff's personnel, the chief's personnel, the district attorney will set himself up as the chief law enforcement officer, and it's this statute and his interpretation of it gives him the full authority to conduct, direct those death investigations. And of course, they have no staff to do that, and so conflict comes in the district attorney's, in my instance, and as well as other sheriffs, of attempting to direct my staff. I resent that very much.
Well, do they purport to do so directly or through you?
Oftentimes directly.
Representative Springer?
Sheriff, let me ask if, in your experience, or if it's been the experience of any members of your association, has, in fact, an investigation been prejudiced by the fact that your personnel are not allowed to exercise the role that you feel this bill would permit them? Or are you aware of any errors that have been committed that might not have been committed if a law enforcement officer had the role that you would like to see in 2448?
Oh, I suppose. I've been involved in death investigations for 28 years, and I've probably changed a lot of the directions that come down from the district attorney's office just by interceding and saying. Now, in our particular county, the district attorney himself, we don't really have all that great deal of problem because we have a good working relationship with him. Some of the deputies, that same thing doesn't exist. And for the most part, it's a lack of knowledge on the deputy's part of what a criminal investigation should consist of. Many other counties have pretty severe problems along those lines. And we don't ask that this bill be modified, changed. All we ask is that it include law enforcement, which currently does not. And I think that's a shame.
Sheriff, it seems to me that perhaps the real critical aspect, though, here is when you're talking about the involvement of the medical examiner and the district attorney, it seems to me we're talking a little more closely to the crime scene itself and the condition of the body and things like that. And in other words, the situation where it requires, some fairly careful work and study and investigation dealing with the body in position and then the removal of the body and its examination thereafter. And I'm not sure that I see particularly the role of, the law enforcement individual, really in close in terms of that investigation versus the role of law enforcement at the scene itself. In other words, it seems to me I've seen situations where law enforcement comes in, they rope off the area, close the area off, hold the area secure until the medical investigator or the deputies can get in there and actually do their work. What's wrong with the present system?
We don't have any problem with the determination of cause of death. None whatsoever. Where we have the problem with is after that has been determined, cause of death has been established, all evidence at the scene has been collected, and then the next day, or the ongoing investigation, according to this law, is the absolute jurisdiction under the absolute jurisdiction of the medical examiner and the district attorney. We think that that is law enforcement function. Law enforcement should be determining, trying to identify, track down, arrest the perpetrator.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but
that's what we're trying to accomplish.
Once this evidence has been collected and identified, and ostensibly set up for preservation for later use, you're not kept from looking at that evidence, examining that evidence, are you, or taking note of what's there and proceeding from there to go after the perpetrators?
Only under the direction of the district attorney. If there's a crime committed in my county and the district attorney is directing that investigation, I might not even be involved in that investigation, let alone be in a position to direct my people to go check this and go check that and go check this neighborhood and this sort of thing.
So your beef then seems to be really with the district attorneys and who leads the investigation after the initial investigation of the death itself and the causes of death.
Yes, we have no problems, and I'm not aware of any problems that we have with the current law or the procedure, those involved with cause of death, preservation of evidence at the scene, those types of things. I'm not aware of any problems on those lines. But when the medical examiner and the district attorney exclusively are the sole responsible for the direction of that total criminal investigation that follows, none of the chiefs of police, he says only the sheriffs, it's also the chiefs of police, or the sheriffs understand that. Why would the sheriff and the chiefs of police be excluded from the criminal investigation that follows a homicide or a violent death?
Okay, to what you say you don't really have any problem in Linn County. Where are we having problems then in the state in who is to conduct or lead the conducting of the investigation?
Well, the Sheriff's Association meeting in December, there was many sheriffs expressed concern. This particular motion for this particular bill came out of Polk County, so I expect there's some concern there. But there's many sheriffs that express concern over this issue.
Does this arise, do you think, out of a conflict between the local sheriffs and their DAs? In other words, perhaps some poor working relationships there?
Possibly so. My own personal belief is that the sheriffs in the state are much more capable a criminal investigation than the district attorneys. We also think the district attorneys have got as much as they can accomplish by prosecuting the cases we present to them without running the investigations. We think that is our responsibility, rightfully our responsibility.
who do the district attorneys use then when they're directing the investigation? Aren't they using your people?
Whoever, yes. They use law enforcement people. But they also, by law, are to direct those people. Personally, I'll direct my own people. As long as I'm sheriff, I'll direct the activities of my deputies. Not the district attorney, not the medical examiner. I will do that. And I think that most sheriffs feel very strongly about that. And I think that most chiefs of police feel very strongly about that.
In your situation in Linn County, though, then, does your DA basically work through you? Let's say he has a request in a particular investigation that he'd like to see you follow this lead or follow that lead. Does he basically then deal with you?
Well, he works fairly close with our office, not necessarily directly through me, but through my chief of detectives or somebody.
Is that with your permission, though?
Oh, yes. The reason I think that I might not have that as big a problem as some other jurisdictions because my particular district attorney is a good friend of mine, and we get along very well. And he doesn't argue this point too strongly with me. But there is many others that do, I understand.
Argue which point, though, as to whether the DA has the authority to directly control the individuals within the sheriff's office or bureaus of police?
He agrees with me that he cannot direct the activities of my deputies. We mutually agree with that. And so, therefore, he doesn't try too much.
Mr. Springer?
I guess I have think I understand the point you're trying to make, that and there may be some jurisdictions where the senior law enforcement officer, maybe the sheriff and the DA don't seem to work together too well. Will the change that you're providing, say, for example, on the first page of the law, in section 2, lines 17 through 19, you're putting the district medical examiner, the DA, and the law enforcement agency having jurisdiction over the place where the death occurred shall be responsible for the investigation. All of a sudden, these two people that you're telling us can't work together, you're requiring that they must somehow work together. Presumably, both are responsible. I just, you know, if it's not working with the present law, how is this change going to make that change that relationship so they can work together?
Well, I think this law would at least recognize that the law enforcement has a role in those particular types of deaths. Law enforcement is usually the first on the scene, always in those kind of deaths. We had one this weekend where we found the skeletal remains of a person that had been dumped maybe sometime late last summer. I've got a deputy up there that, under this bill, doesn't have the authority to do anything until somebody else arrives 40 miles from someplace that has proper authority under the current law. Don't make sense to me. A lot of the deaths, we can't, we're not permitted to remove clothing or this sort of thing. A lot of the deaths, the local medical examiner tells us, fine, we'll check on him tomorrow. Does us a lot of good at 3 o'clock in the morning out here in a boondock someplace. We ought to have just a little more jurisdiction in those kind of things.
Further questions?
Thank you, Sheriff. Mr. Bubis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. members of the committee. My name is Ted Bugis, and I'm here representing the Oregon, the Association of Oregon Chiefs of Police and the Oregon Peace Officers Association. And I'm going to start out my first appearance before this group after having shared the podium with some of you in the recent past by apologizing, because these two groups which I represent are on this bill as requesters of the legislation erroneously, and the error is ours in our government affairs company. The bill was reviewed at the request of a member of your staff and Representative Courtney's, and it was glanced over with several others hurriedly, and the bill was authorized to contain the request of these two organizations as requesters. We regret that. We're sorry for it. Neither association has considered the bill before its bodies or its executive groups and authorized this kind of request. So the authorization given to the staff of the committee and Representative Courtney's staff was in error. We're not aware of a problem under the current procedures and laws governing the medical examiner's conduct. We have not discussed this, to the best of my ability to determine, upon finding out this error, which has just been in the last, frankly, just today. And I don't see listening to the testimony that's been given here today, I don't see how the passage of the bill would solve a problem if there's a hassle between the district attorney and the heads of the law enforcement agencies locally anyway. We have nothing but the highest respect for Dr. Brady and the medical examiner's office, and very sorry that this occurred.
Ted, I want to make sure I understand. Are you saying that the two associations you represent have not yet decided whether they're going to take a position on this bill?
We've never even had the bill before the group.
So as of this time, there is not a formal position as to either bill?
As to either bill, you're either group.
Either group, excuse me.
Neither group has even studied the bill as a committee or as a whole.
Does either organization tend to take a definite position on the bill for or against?
Well,
or is this
since we are on it, we owe them at least the explanation that we've just given this committee. As a practical matter, we haven't even had a chance to get back to them. There are members in the room of these organizations, and they were kind of surprised that the names appeared on there, and we thought it was just a breakdown. They thought it was a breakdown in communications, and it was an inadvertent error on our part.
Well, if your names were not on this bill, the organizations you represent would obviously be affected by the bill, and thus I would think might be taking a position one way or the other. I'm not saying necessarily for. Will the organizations be taking a definite position?
We will,
one way or the other.
We'll consider it, Mr. Chairman, and come back to you with a position on the bill if that's your desire. In the best effort of Ted and myself to discuss it and try to achieve some kind of a position today, short of going to the members, which is what we really need to do as their representatives, it doesn't seem to us there's a need for the bill.
Questions? Ted, thank you very much. I appreciate your information. Before we leave the bill, Dr. Brady, you've been kind enough to stay. You've heard the review of principal concerns that underlie the bill, at least as seen by the sheriffs. Do you have any further comment you'd like to share with the committee before we close our hearing on this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll make my remarks brief.
This law under which our office operates does not, to my knowledge, nor is it intended to hamper the investigation of criminal activity on the part of law enforcement people. I have, like the sheriff, been involved in death investigation for over 25 years. I don't know a Miranda right. I abhor guns. I don't chase criminals, and I don't intend to. The sections that are up for revision in 2448 do not address, in my opinion, the question of pursuing criminals. And we can go over them one by one by one. The authority to request me to do an autopsy. The taking custody of the body and its effects. The authority to undress and embalm the body. The authority to rope off, lock, and close buildings. The authority to keep someone from entering the area. The authority to take blood and urine for laboratory analysis. And finally, the authority to order an autopsy, in my opinion, does not address the problems that the sheriff was discussing. The final comment, and I find the sheriff and I agreeing, I think, in almost all areas. When he spoke about the fact that there was a death that occurred down in Linn County recently and the law enforcement personnel who was there had to call in someone, the sheriff said, from 40 miles away. I'm sure he's right, and let me explain exactly what we have in mind. And here is the whole intent of our law. It's very intentional. The intention is to get somebody out there at the scene of a death who knows what they're doing and is in charge, so that an inexperienced person without adequate training and experience cannot get up and bollocks things. That's the whole intent. Therefore, we determine, and I don't, the person who is in charge is determined by an elected official of the county, by a responsible physician who is approved by the Board of County Commissioners. The sheriff must be one of these people by statute. And then they are individually selected and individually appointed. If the fact that the person that was out there was not a deputy medical examiner, this indicates by definition that this person has, for some local reason, not met the qualifications of the people who operate the county program have established as people they want to be the first person on the scene to take charge. It's working exactly the way it's intended to work. Does it cut out some inexperienced persons? For example, if this bill were to go in, would every single community in the state who has one or two police officers have total responsibility for all of the murders in that city of a population of 200 or 300 people? Ah, yes, they would. They would be complete in charge. And the experience of some of these people is such that I believe other more experienced people, such as the sheriff, would best be in charge. I thank the committee.
Okay. Representative Lombard.
Okay, again, so what you're, I guess we are, I think, differentiating here then, that you're talking about having the experts at the scene to be able to determine cause of death and what evidence should and should not be preserved. And that seems to me to be different from the sheriff's concern that he expressed about perhaps thereafter, their problems with the DAs and who directs the investigation thereafter. Do you feel that you and the sheriff agree? Am I hearing you both say the same thing with regards to your having your experts or the county's having its medical experts or death investigator experts there to determine cause of death and preserve the evidence?
We're agreeing, but we're disagreeing. And I'm, with all due respect to the sheriff, I think the issue is becoming a bit fuzzy, and I'd like to sharply delineate it. And I would like to place in time separate, two separate, to me, aspects of the investigation. Okay. One is pursuing the crooks, and I don't pursue crooks. The other is keeping the body as it is, deciding which cases, and remember now, we're talking about 20,000 deaths a year in the state of Oregon, of which less than 150 are homicides. And the committee does not have time for war stories. However, should the committee wish, I could share enormous numbers of situations where very well-intentioned and well-meaning men and women in law enforcement without a medical background have misconstrued natural deaths with, sadly, some very tragic consequences to the families involved in these tragedies. And I can tell stories of families with crib deaths being appraised of their Miranda rights. So in response to your question, Representative Lombard, we have no question but that at the scene,
the physician, and if there is a question of a crime, I want an attorney there, have responsibility. Chasing the crooks is not a section of our law, and I certainly have no intention whatsoever of asking the legislature to give me authority to chase crooks.
Let me put it to you this way, which is perhaps another way of asking the same thing. This, the question of death investigation, as established by this chapter, is separate, does not comprehend the pursuit of the of individuals who may have in fact committed a criminally caused death.
It does not, Mr. Chairman. It is not intended
death
to...
Death investigation as a term of art in this section of our code does not extend to that form of activity.
It does. That's correct. The phraseology which one of the physicians instructed me used is rather colloquial, but I think it's expressive. We tell them what did it. They tell us who did it. We're not Quincy. And I'm afraid... that crazy TV show.
The need for the defendant to be personally present.
I think if there's no objection, what I'll do is let the bill go on as we have voted it. And the staff and I will work further with Mr. Hennings to see if we can refine some additional amendments. If it appears those are of a nature that would require the subcommittee to spend more time on, I'll put the bill back on our agenda for the consideration of those amendments if there are some developed. If it appears that they might be fairly easily added to the bill at the full committee level, without a great deal of difficulty, technically or otherwise, if there's no objection, we'll just do that at the full committee. Okay. Okay. 5 minute recess.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
I'm still putting it.
Then I'll add mine now.
Who gives a damn? I know.
Please, Jeff, because he was better read than
Ben. Subcommittee will return to order.
Okay.
Our next bill is House Bill 2450. Don't have anyone on the sign up sheet, but I assume. The Political Action Committee is represented. Yes, come on.
Is this your? This is your bill, right?
That's your bill. That's
your one. Would you keep it over there, please?
Sorry.
I was momentarily.
Excuse me. Sorry.
My name is Gail Castillo, and I'm president of the Hispanic Political Action Committee. And I, first of all, wanted to thank all of you for taking your time and allowing us to testify in favor of this particular bill, HB 2450. One of the reasons we requested the bill was because of some of the community concerns that did arise out of the INS activity that all of you, I'm sure, heard about or read about in the newspaper or saw in the news cast. There were a lot of concerns from the general Hispanic community about the raids that happened this summer and this fall. What I've done is I've made copies of a testimony that was prepared by one of our members, Rocky Maria, on behalf of HPAC. He, as you can see, has an extensive background in immigration law and has done a lot of research and worked on behalf of this bill. He was unable to be here this afternoon, so I wanted to read it for him, or at least read from it. First of all, the law under the United States Constitution, Preemption Clause, the Immigration Naturalization Act, U.S. Attorney General Bell's opinion, Oregon Attorney General Redden's opinion, and several court decisions, it is clear that the state and local law enforcement officers have no authority to enforce immigration law. The authority to enforce immigration laws is delegated to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. The problems The majority of law enforcement agencies seem to understand the law and do not attempt to enforce immigration laws. However, some local law enforcement agencies have attempted to enforce immigration laws by themselves or in conjunction with the INS. The justification for these illegal practices are threefold. One, they have done it in the past and do not understand why they cannot continue to do it. Two, they are sworn to uphold the laws of this country and are doing so by looking for the illegal aliens. Three, they do not understand the law because there is no state law covering this matter. The courts have said that these are not valid reasons. In Oregon, there have been several lawsuits regarding these illegalities. In fact, Mr. Barria prevailed in the case of Trevino versus City of Independence Police and Polk County Sheriffs in 1977. The ramifications of illegal enforcement. Hispanics and other ethnic minorities, including United States citizens and aliens, are detained, they're interrogated, and harassed by local law enforcement agencies on the basis of skin color, language, and dress. This is a violation of one's right to privacy and constitutional rights. Hispanics and other minorities are treated as second-class citizens. Two, local law enforcement agencies are not trained in immigration law. Local police are usually trained only in criminal law, which remains fairly constant. Immigration law, however, is not a criminal law. It is civil law and is constantly changing. INS agents are specifically trained in enforcement of the immigration laws. I think this is an important note, that the law enforcement agencies do not enforce the federal income tax law, okay, which is also not criminal, which is civil. Local governments have to expend monies out of their coffers in defending these types of cases. They are also quite time-consuming. In most cases, the local government's insurance does not cover civil rights violations, and therefore additional legal counsel must be retained. This is costly to local governments, not to mention increasing the court's caseloads. Four, high-priority criminal law enforcement and investigation is being subdued for the purpose of enforcing low-priority, non-criminal matters. This does not set well with the local taxpayers when local law enforcement agencies are trying to justify their budgets. The purpose of the bill. The purpose of the bill is to resolve the problems of the state and local law enforcement agencies enforcing immigration laws. The bill will be a restatement of what the law is and give an Oregon statute citation of what the law is. Hopefully this bill will better educate the local law enforcement agencies as to what the law is. And again, Mr. Buddy is available for further questioning. Hispanic Political Action, any of our other members who also would be available for further information. I don't know if you have any questions of me.
I take it from the citations that there is absolutely no question that Congress has restricted the enforcement of these laws to the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
I'm not an attorney. I have other people here who are attorneys, but that, based on the reading that I've done of all the laws, that is true. The local law enforcement people, and I do have a copy of the Redding decision, do not have the ability to enforce immigration law. If there has been a crime committed, then naturally, any state crime committed, they have the ability to come in and arrest someone, or if they feel that a crime has been, and if they suspect that a crime has been committed.
Okay, further questions?
I guess
Representative Springer.
Just a question as to where this kind of problem has arisen, say, in the past year or two. Are there, I take it you wouldn't be here, but for the fact that there are still local jurisdictions that are apparently, reason or the other, are engaged in this kind of activity.
We've had numerous incidences out in Washington County, in the Woodburn area. Again, like the testimony says, people, whether they're citizens or not citizens, are being stopped in their cars through traffic blocks, roadblocks, asked to come out, asked extensive questions about their background, where they're from, approached in English and in Spanish, a lot of them who were American citizens on their way to work in, during the summer in the fields, dressed appropriately, were suspected of being illegal aliens. And a lot of the people who were raised in this local area did not go to work because they didn't want to be personally harassed nor have their family, their children, harassed in this manner. And that's the real concern. We just don't want people, because of the way they dress or the pigmentation of their skin or their hair, to be stopped in this manner when they're just trying to do their job and report to work, make a living. So we are having lots of problems in this area.
The questions being asked in those situations relate primarily or solely to matters that, well, the questions are directed primarily or solely toward matters that would only pertain to a violation of the immigration laws.
But the
is that right?
Yes. If I may add something here. If I myself, or perhaps members of the committee, were asked to prove at this particular moment your birth, place of birth, most people would not have any documentation on them to prove one way or the other. You know, some of us could have been born in Canada. Some of us could have been born in different parts of the United States or in Mexico. None of us really have proof of that. And that is a real issue. You know, how do you prove and how do you convince an officer who's not sure about, because of your dress or because of your color, that you are indeed a citizen? You have to start carrying things around with you, I guess. But it's a feeling of harassment.
Other questions? Linda, do you have any questions or comments?
No. Are the federal authorities able to make those kinds of stops?
According to the information I have here, they can make stops. And there's some question about, like, if they're 60 miles from the border, they feel it's even more appropriate because the influx of people would justify them stopping. Since we're further away from the border in terms of either border, there's a question about whether it's appropriate to set up roadblocks and ask those kinds of questions. But the bill here is not even dealing with the federal authority. It's dealing with the question of the local enforcement officers and the role that they play in the enforcement. I don't think we can question the federal law. We're not trying to question that. We're trying to question the local officer's involvement in that role.
Okay, thanks.
Further? Thank you very much. Is anyone else here to testify on this bill? I don't know if Linda, you have had an opportunity alone or in conjunction with legislative counsel to review the provisions of the text of the bill to determine if there are any technical issues of drafting that need to be addressed. Subject to that and any possible further amendment for that reason, the chair would entertain a motion on the bill if it's the interest of the subcommittee to do so.
Mr. Chair, I would note that I believe this was prepared in with the assistance of Frank Gruber from the Legislative Council's office, so hopefully if there were any problems with that form or style. I know he did research this subject at my request, and I think it's probably passed that test, and
right.
I would so move this to the full committee with a DPAS recommendation.
Is there further discussion? Call the roll.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Chairman?
Aye. Good. Thank you. 2446, our old friend. Norton.
Mr. Chair. members of the committee. If it'll be all right, you'd like to have the...
Well, this is a sheriff's bill, I see, too. Yeah. Sheriff Eastman? I'm sorry. I thought this was a bill through the state.
Yeah.
Fine. Wally, do you want to come up?
Hand out too much to speak. Oh, you there.
Go ahead. Yes, will you maintain order when
can we vote on that?
Just wondering where you're going, Mr. Chair. We lost it. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Major Sterling Norton. I'm the Game Division Commander of the State Police. This bill was in the last session, and we supported with amendments that were made to it last time. And these amendments were simply on line 9 would be delete the word commission and insert law enforcement agency making the seizure. Basically, what this would do is put the evidence into the person or the agency that seized its custody and their responsibility. Presently, what happens now, this is all commercial fish equipment. Generally, our department seizes most of it, and then by law, we release it to the sheriff, and he holds it until such time as it's either returned to the fisherman or it's ordered forfeited by the court, and then it's sold, and the money goes to the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Now, on line 15, there's some confusion in the existing language, and we would ask that after the word property, you would delete less actual verified law enforcement costs and insert less actual costs incurred by the law enforcement agency in storing the property. I took the liberty of attaching the old amendment to the back of my statement so that you can see what I'm asking for. Then on line 20, you would again delete the word commission and insert law enforcement agency having custody of the property. If these amendments were approved and the bill passed, it would cost our department a little bit of money in storing our own evidence. And primarily I'm talking about gill nets and small boats. It could be large vessels if the circumstances were such, but the history is that we take about 75 nets a year out of the Columbia River and some of the coastal streams, and somewhat less than a half a dozen small boats. I think in many cases we have good cooperation with other agencies such as the Sheriff's Office, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Highway Department, and we can put those things at no extra cost to us. In the event that this didn't happen, we could rent a mini storage or something like that and probably get by for $1,500 to buy any of them. The only time there would be an exception is if we happen to have some large-scale fishing where we were required to seize a large number of fishing boats or something like that, but it hasn't happened in the past. I don't expect it to. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions?
Mr. Chair. What are the problems under the current law, then, that prompt this kind of a proposal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lombard, this was at the request last time, I believe, to the Sheriff's Association, perhaps he should answer, but it came from Clatsop County. They were having to store our seizures.
I see.
Chair, Mr. Lombard, the problem...
Could you identify yourself, please?
Oh, sorry. I am Al Eastman. I'm Sheriff of Clatsop County. This bill was originally, I believe, brought about by Sheriff Carl Bondetti, who had retired. The main problem that we were running into is storing the fishing gear, paying mortgage for boats, the liability to the county to keep the boat from sinking or vandalism, and then if it was sold, the money went to the commission. 99% of the time, everything is given back to the fishermen by the courts, or the fish commission would receive the items to be used at their disposal, and the county comes in on the short end of the cost. If we could get the bill passed as the major has brought it up with the changes, we would have no problems with it within our county.
Let me ask this. I don't remember. I remember the bill 2 years ago, but I don't remember. Does the court require
payment of storage fees and moorage be collected from the person charged if they're found guilty? Whoever knows.
Generally not. I don't know of any cases where they've done that. The person loses his property, that's usually the penalty besides whatever criminal penalty he incurred.
I'm just curious, one or both of you made the comment that frequently the property ends up going back to the person charged. Now, is that even upon a finding of guilty?
Quite often that happens. Depends on what it is. If it's a boat, I would think most times they get it back. Gill nets in small coastal streams south of the Columbia, that's not true. On the Columbia, quite often when some of this equipment that's seized, we never know whose it is. It's just pulled out of the water.
Okay. It just seemed to me the ultimate fairness would be to, particularly in the event of a conviction, to require the individual to pay the mortgage or whatever expenses you undergo. I don't know, Raleigh, do you know what the situation is?
Representative Lombard, could you give us your...
For the table.
Raleigh Russo, Department of Fish and Wildlife, I can't really respond beyond what Major Norton did. That is not the current provision of the law, and right now the sheriff does carry the burden of that story. This way basically puts it back on the state through the Oregon State Police, who is the enforcement entity that, for all practical purposes, makes most all of the seizures as it deals with commercial fishing gear.
I guess the point I'm trying to get at is that if we seize property and we store it or moor it, and the court decides to give it back and not forfeit it, then my question is whether there is the ability of the court to require, as a condition of probation or sentence or what have you, that the convicted individual pay the costs of storage, mortgage, or whatever. I'm just trying to see if the bill says, where'd Linda go? She's gone.
She's gone with the
sheriff.
They're in the back room.
My guess is, Representative Lombard, that the court would have that discretion today, but apparently they're not exercising.
Okay.
Linda, is it right?
Linda, the question I had was whether these gentlemen have testified that frequently after the property is seized and stored or moored, that it's returned to the person convicted. My question was, does the court have the authority to charge the convicted individual with the costs of storage or mortgage during the time that the property's in the hands of the law enforcement agency?
I couldn't respond off the top, but I would be happy to check into it.
Seems to me that would be particularly appropriate in the case where the property is being returned.
I don't know if it's like a restitution provision, but to state agencies, and it doesn't offhand strike me that they do that, but I'll check into it.
Representative Lombard, if I may, most of the time through our agency, the only time we make the second contact with either the state police or the violator is when we get a court order that just flat says, return all items. And far from us to go to the court and tell the judge to collect money.
We can tell them to.
Yes, sir, you can.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lombard, I think from a practical sense, in our fiscal impact, at least, that was prepared for this bill 2 years ago, it was a reasonably small amount of money we're talking about on a biennial basis. It was estimated at that time around $1,000 burden that would be placed on primarily Oregon State Police, and being that their budget is to some degree is within the Department of Fish and Wildlife's budget, that is picked up by the department. So the paperwork on, for example, on a gill net, particularly if you have a facility in the area that you're using day in and day out, probably be greater than the...
Have no problem. I'm just thinking that if you If you seize a vessel, however, and given the time period that you have to wait for trial and you have substantial mortgage costs, then it seems to me that a little more justice in there. If you require as a condition to the return of the vessel that the individual pay back those mortgage costs. I agree with you. Gil Nets, you probably have in every county or every location a shed where you can store it in the corner. That's not really what I was thinking about.
Chairman, you're correct. It could be rather substantial on a large fishing vessel for any length of time that the boat would be moored.
Yeah.
What is the sheriff's position with respect to the amendments which essentially bring the bill to the form as approved by this committee and the House in 81?
That I cannot answer, Mr. Chairman, as I wasn't involved with it back in 81. So I'm not quite sure of the question. Chairman, I was just advised that we support the amendments that are here today.
Well, committee's been around this bush at least once before.
Well, I have no problem with the bill.
Yeah.
I say I have no problem with the bill. I just...
With the amendments? And
yeah.
Representative Courtney.
Where's Fish and Wildlife on the amendments?
No, we favor the bill with as amended, or as the amendments are proposed. Yes, we opposed it without those amendments.
Are there any other matters not addressed by the amendments that the subcommittee wants pursued?
The only question I raised, Mr. Chair, is the question of, as long as we're apportioning costs in this thing, that if you have substantial costs in the seizures and storage or mortgage, more likely the mortgage of an item of seized property, can the court assess those costs against a person convicted of a violation that is the genesis of the seizure? What these gentlemen were saying earlier in their initial part of their testimony was that more often than not, the property is returned to the person who's been convicted. That's fine if that's the judgment of the court, but if there happens to be a large vessel that is seized and substantial mortgage costs are paid by the law enforcement or incurred by the law enforcement agency that seizes the vessel, it doesn't seem to me appropriate that that vessel can just simply be turned back to the violator without making a condition of return of the vessel the payment of the mortgage costs. My question is, I don't know what they couldn't answer.
You were not able to answer that question.
I'm not certain, Mr. Chairman, whether I can answer it exactly, but I might remind you that quite often these cases are Class C felonies, so the court would have a $100,000 penalty available to him. And then the other commercial fish violations are graduated penalties, so whether he actually paid for the mortgage or not, he might pay anyway.
Okay, whatever.
Do you want this pursued further, or that issue, Representative?
Well, I'd ask them. They're the folks that are going to end up paying for it. You want to pursue it?
Well, I guess the point I was making a little earlier, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lombard, I think if you chose an arbitrary amount, it's for discussion purpose, $100, any cost for storage exceeding $100, the court shall, attach or however the language would be to whatever penalty is given. It's nothing. Be fine with us, whether that's the reasonable number or it's something greater than that, I don't know. I think Major Norton indicated at this point in time, at least in the past tense, that has not been a major problem. However, given the situation we have in the ocean in the last couple of years, that could become more of a problem. So, it's a reasonable question I think you've raised.
I'm just thinking that I'd like to give the court the authority to make as a condition of the release of the seized property the payment of the storage or mortgage costs. I'd just as soon leave it in the discretion of the court to decide whether or not to make it a condition, because the court may decide that they're going to ding the individual for a big fine, whatever, and cover it by that. Except we have to keep in mind the fines go to the state and probably the mortgage fees go to the local law enforcement folks who incur the costs, unless Fish and Wildlife incurs those costs. See, I guess, again, in our bifurcated system, where we have the state getting the fines and getting that side of it, those fines would not otherwise cover and go to the seizing agency if, for instance, it was the Clatsop County Sheriff. They don't have the authority to seize.
Mr. Chairman, the question was with the where the fine went to the half of went to county, and without looking, I can't say, but it always has in the past, but since they changed this court system, I'm not certain whether they changed that particular statute or not.
Yeah. All right, Mr. Chairman, I'll stick my neck out. I would like to pursue that as an added provision of the bill.
All right, let's take this in two steps. Chair would move the adoption of the Department of State Police Game Division amendments to House Bill 436. No, pardon me, to 24.
Let's do it.
46, as distributed to the committee. Is there any objection?
Okay.
All right, those amendments are adopted. Now, Representative Lombard, would you like to state your additional amendment?
All right, it's a conceptual amendment. Mr. Chair, it would simply be that there be a provision added to the bill if this authority does not already exist. Allow the court to make as a condition of return of any seized item under this law that the violator pay the costs of storage or mortgage of the item. I guess that probably covers it.
Discussion? No. Before I put that to vote, what about the issue of the disposition of that payment, is that automatically taken care of in some other way?